Democrats have hammered their case against the president.
President Trump tried to cheat, he got caught, and then he worked hard to cover it up.
And today, his defense team takes the stage.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, and this is Up First from NPR News.
Travel restrictions on tens of millions of people in China. Face masks and long lines at hospitals as the coronavirus spreads.
How officials are trying to contain the outbreak just as new cases are confirmed in Europe and the United States.
And with new testimony in a Guantanamo Bay courtroom, what we learned about the CIA's torture program after 9/11.
Waterboarding, stress positions, mock burials. An interrogator says it all went too far.
Please stay with us. We have the news you need to start your weekend.
The House impeachment managers are done for now.
Last night, they finished their opening arguments in the Senate trial to remove President Trump. Today, the president's lawyers take their turn as they defend his actions in the Ukraine affair.
NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now with a preview. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Lulu.
The Democrats spent their time, which spanned 3 days, to make their case that President Trump abused his power by asking Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden, just so he could say Biden was under investigation. Are there any signs at all that they've convinced Republican senators on this?
There are no signs that they have convinced any Republican senators to vote for removal, let alone 20 Republican senators, which is the number they'd need to remove him. That's why they've been appealing to what they call two juries, the senators and also the public, when they say that leaving the president in office would leave him as an imminent threat to the integrity of our democracy. They've also been trying to get a handful of Republicans, four is the number they need, to agree to vote to call witnesses. They want to hear from people like John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney. And at this point, if Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump don't want witnesses, it's very hard to see the political incentive for any Republican senator to be the fourth vote for witnesses.
So we're hearing from the other side today, and it sounds like President Trump's attorneys plan to talk about Joe Biden and how his son took a job with a Ukrainian gas company. Here's what Jay Sekulow said yesterday.
Why they opened up the door as wide as a double door on the Hunter Biden, Joe Biden Burisma issue, I guess they figured that was their way of getting ahead of it. We will address it.
That's the president's lawyer. Mara, what do we know about the defense strategy?
Sekulow said they're going to spend just a few hours today giving an overview of their rebuttals. He called it coming attractions, kind of like a trailer or a preview. That's because Saturday is not a great day for TV ratings, as the president himself tweeted. He called it Death Valley on TV on Twitter yesterday.
He did.
So the White House team will save their best material for prime time next week, but it sounds like they're going to air President Trump's grievances. Sekulow said they're going to argue that Democrats asked for foreign interference in 2016 when they paid for that Oppo research document known as the Steele dossier. That's not really relevant to the articles of impeachment. And obviously, as you just heard him, he said they would talk about Joe Biden. So when Republican senators say they want a fact-based defense from the White House, they might not get that.
What is the big picture here about where this seems to be headed?
The big question for me is what kind of message the Senate will send. You know, Nancy Pelosi said the House vote to impeach Trump was a permanent stain on his record. The House sent a permanent message. But if he's acquitted in the Senate, does that mean the message the Senate is sending that it was okay for a president to ask a foreign government to dig up dirt on his political rival? Does it mean that the president gets to come before Congress on February 4th at the State of the Union address and say, I was totally exonerated. The Senate said that I was right all along when I say that Article 2 of the Constitution allows me to do whatever I want. In other words, does it embolden him to continue to ask for foreign interference? Or does the Senate send a different kind of message? They acquit him, but they stand up and senators say that they still don't think that what he did was right, or in Mitt Romney's words, that it was wrong and appalling, but it doesn't merit removal.
That's NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for a full update on what happens today in the Senate trial, be sure to check out the NPR Politics podcast. $46 million people are now effectively in quarantine during China's busiest travel season of the year.
Local governments have canceled holiday events marking the Lunar New Year. Schools are closing an extra 2 weeks in Hong Kong. It's all to control the outbreak of a deadly new respiratory disease that began in China but has now spread globally.
We're joined now by NPR's Emily Fang in Beijing. Emily, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
How many cities now on lockdown?
It's at least 13 now, and that includes Wuhan, which is the city where the virus originated. As you mentioned, that's 46 million people under quarantine, and that doesn't include the 14,000 people they say they have under direct observation, plus the random temperature checks they're doing in hospitals and train stations across the country. And all of this is coming during Lunar New Year, which is a holiday where people are supposed to be traveling and eating dinner with their family. But despite the inconvenience that all of this has caused, people are widely supportive, even if critics say some of these measures are coming a little too late. The real problem now is the shortage of medical staff. Doctors in Hubei province, which is where Wuhan is located and where the quarantine zone is, are working such crazy hours that some of them have had emotional breakdowns. One doctor actually died today of cardiac arrest. His colleagues say it was because of overwork. And so China's now sending doctors to Hubei to supplement. China's armed forces say they're sending 450 army medics to help as well. We'll see if that makes a difference.
How prepared are authorities to deal with a long-term outbreak?
As of this week, they're very prepared. China is scarred by the memory of SARS, which belongs in the same family of the coronavirus that we're seeing today. It killed 800 people. It's a number that many say is higher than it needed to be if Beijing had not covered up how bad the problem was in the beginning. This time around, China's really leveraging its top-down economy. It can forcibly tell people, you can go to this place, you can't go to this place. It can tell companies to do certain things. Here's what Hubei's health authority said at their last press conference.
Nanjing Yiyao Hubei and other large pharmaceutical producers, we had meetings with them, make sure they shoulder the due responsibilities and also is forbidden to stocking the masks and in driving up the price. So they make their commitment to the public and also work hard to allocate the masks, make sure we have enough supply.
So they can do things like tell companies to control food prices. They forced airlines to cancel all flights for free, including mine. But the outbreak is getting more serious. Today, we saw the first death of a doctor who had contracted the virus from a patient die. He was a 62-year-old doctor named Liang Wudong.
Emily, we're seeing the number of people who've died increase. Do the Chinese people see that same number? Do they trust what they've been told by the government?
They see the same number, but they don't trust it. There are numerous accusations online of an initial cover-up, so there's a lot of anger. There were calls from the Hubei party paper today for the leaders to step down. The paper apologized for those remarks, but the anger is very real.
NPR's Emily Fang in Beijing, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Now to startling testimony at the U.S. military court in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It was during a hearing this week for the five men charged in the September 11th terrorist attacks. One of those men, according to the testimony, was used as what the witness called a training prop for CIA employees so they could learn the agency's torture techniques.
Sasha Pfeiffer of NPR's investigations team has been in Guantanamo listening to that testimony. She joins us now. Sasha, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Training prop sounds awfully chilling. What does it mean?
This involves a prisoner named Ammar al-Baluchi. He's the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged 9/11 mastermind, and he's accused of helping finance the hijackers. After al-Baluchi was captured, he was held in a secret CIA prison in Afghanistan. And while there, he was put through an interrogation session by CIA employees who used that session to help themselves earn certification in what the CIA called enhanced interrogation techniques.
Which is a euphemism for torture, yes?
Yes, it definitely is. Al-Baluchi was slammed into a wall. He was doused with water. He was slapped multiple times in the face and stomach. That's according to an unclassified CIA document that was presented in court. He was also put in stress positions for nearly an hour, forced to lean at an angle against a wall using only his forehead, and forced to kneel backwards to an extreme degree that can make your knees feel like they're dislocating.
And this torture earned his interrogator some kind of certification.
Yes, these were CIA employees who were already qualified in these enhanced interrogation techniques, but who needed more hands-on training to help become certified. That's according to one of al-Baluchi's defense lawyers. In court, his lead attorney read portions of a classified CIA report that the government permitted him to read out loud. And that report shows that one interrogator described himself as a student doing on-the-job training. Another said that before al-Baluchi's interrogation, he had felt like he was falling behind because he needed to practice interrogation techniques. Others said, and this is a quote, they were trying to learn how to apply coercion.
Sasha, please tell us more about the witness who called this prisoner a training tool. Who is he?
He is a retired Air Force psychologist named James Mitchell. He co-owned a company that was paid $80 million by the CIA to develop its torture program, and he personally waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Mitchell was called to the stand because lawyers for the 9/11 defendants want the judge to throw out all the statements they made to the FBI on grounds they're tainted by torture, and they want to use Mitchell's testimony to help support their argument.
You listened to testimony all week. What else did he say?
You know, what was really striking is that Mitchell had kind of a conflicting message. At first, he was combative and argumentative and clearly felt unfairly portrayed as a villain. He said he was just trying to protect our country from another attack, and the government was justified in using what he called coercive physical pressure on suspected terrorists to try to get information from them. But then later, he said he thought the CIA had gone too far and maybe breaking the law. He described one prison where men were chained naked to the ground in cold weather in what looked like horse stalls, he described them. And even he was uncomfortable with that. The very man who helped design the torture program was objecting to some of the torture.
Sasha Pfeiffer of NPR's investigation team, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that's a first for Saturday, January 25th, 2020. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First is back on Monday with news to start your day. And follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And of course, you know the news doesn't stop in these important times. When this podcast ends, we've got a solution for that.
It's called Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday. Find it on your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
Want to learn how to make an amazing podcast, kind of like this one?
Check out NPR's podcast about the Student Podcast Challenge. It's full of tips and tricks and bits of inspiration. There's new episodes every Sunday.
That's NPR's Student Podcast Challenge, the podcast. Listen now.